Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
So if any of you don't have these little programs, Benton has more for you, because at the end we're going to be talking off them. Anybody doesn't have them, raise your hand and Benton will pass them out to you. Here's two or three or four people. Oh, okay. Well, then you look off on your neighbor. So here we are this morning, and I'm sitting on the high seat. If you read the scriptures, you read the Indian scriptures, the Chinese scriptures, and the Japanese scriptures, they always talk about the teacher being on the high seat. So, hey, what a deal. Finally, I've arrived. And you guys may get to be on the high seat. Actually, you already are on the high seat, because the high seat is the low seat, and the low seat is the high seat. So here we are together. Hey, what a deal. Okay. So this is my second of two talks on difficulty as opportunity, which I actually think is what Zen practice is. As I was saying to Andrea the other day, that's the whole thing. That's Zen practice. Difficulty is opportunity. So that's why it calls for two lectures, two talks, with some redundancy, which is should be fine, because everything is never the same anyway, really. So difficulty is opportunity. Oh, a seat for Francie. The high seat for Francie. Oh, a high seat back there for Francie. So, as I said last time, a diamond is a piece of coal which has thrived under great stress. That's our practice. A diamond is a piece of coal which has thrived under great stress. And I want to talk a little bit about what we usually do instead of working with difficulty as opportunity, which is spiritual bypassing. Some of you know this term, some of you are very familiar with it, some of you are not. It was coined by my friend and teacher John Wellwood in the late 70s, early 80s, Buddhist psychologist. So what do we mean by that? We mean practices and beliefs to avoid dealing with uncomfortable feelings, uncomfortable wounds, emotional and psychological needs, which we all have as human beings, regardless of how high our seat becomes. We just have them. And so what do we do? What are forms of spiritual bypass? I'll spend 10 or 15 minutes talking about some forms of spiritual bypass. We withdraw from ourselves. We withdraw from others. We hide behind our spiritual beliefs and practices. We use spiritual practices and beliefs to distance ourselves from our pain, from our personal issues. We may demonstrate exaggerated gentleness, niceness, superficiality, what the Tibetans call idiot compassion. Now, some of you have never heard that, but that's a commonly used term in one of the Tibetan lineages, idiot compassion. Or we detach ourselves emotionally, we numb, we repress, we cover our negative emotions. So I'm fictionalizing this friend of mine named Jerome, who got attached to this wonderful Indian guru, Amachi, and the hugging guru. How many of you have heard of Amachi? A lot of you have. I went to see her too. I got hugged by her. That's why I get to sit on the high seat. No. And so the vibe that he got there kind of became addicting to him. He wasn't doing his drugs or alcohol anymore, but he began following her around. and bypassing his own issues, bypassing his own depression, what he need to deal with in the relationship with his self, with his wife, with his comrades, with his friends. So spiritual bypassing is not something bad. We just subtly move into it and need to notice it. Need to notice it. It also may support weak or too porous boundaries or delusions that having arrived at a higher level of being. So I'm getting some examples, three from my own life and two others from my life too, but not so much about me. First of all, first, repression. So when I first began practicing meditation and doing Zen, I was in love with this teacher, the writings of this teacher named Alan Watts. And people still like Alan Watts, but he was like the man back then. We all read Alan Watts. And I much preferred to read Alan Watts than sitting in meditation. And people would tell me it was time to sit, and I'd say, no, I'm reading Alan Watts. And that was okay, but I was really avoiding dealing with my own anxiety of just being with it in a kind way by reading Alan Watts over and over and over again. I had the whole bookmark on every page, underlined, double underlined, triple underlined. Alan Watts, Alan Watts. And, you know, that's just an example. Second example we kind of see our teacher often as being constantly at peace, or we feel peaceful in the Zendo. So then we kind of fake being constantly at peace. We don't know we're faking it. I mean, I really wanted to be a priest many years ago, and I knew that if I showed my warts, it seemed like I wouldn't get to be a priest. So I didn't show my warts because I wanted to be a priest. So I didn't deal with my issues, really. I just was being nice, gosh-showing a lot. Doing this. This is the gosho, for those of you who don't know, and in Japanese gosho all the time. That's part of the way they are. And as I got more into doing it, I would gosho more and more. And everybody goshoed more and more. And there's no problem with that. But are we covering up? Are we covering up really how we feel inside, who we are, by doing this? So I don't know if my wife even remembers this. Actually, she claims not to remember anything that's in my book about her. She says that I misremember everything, and it could be true because she has a better memory than I do. But anyway, my memory is my memory, right? So I remember her getting kind of angry at me in the car a couple of times, and I would just do a little gusho to her. And I was fuming inside, but I was just doing a little gusho. I was trying to do the practice. I thought that was what Zen was. And so, but that's spiritual bypassing, right? It's not bad. It's just what we do because we're confused. We want to do something good. We want to be peaceful. We want to be peaceful. So there was a guy who was the Eno there. Wanda is the Eno now. Is Wanda here today? Oh, Wanda is the Eno. She just took over from Mark. You know, the Eno is the big is the next to the guiding teacher is the big person who controls everything. So the Eno there was a guy named Dick, and he really aggravated me. He seems like he was always pushing me around, pushing others around, but especially picking on me. Personalized it, picking on me. And Linda said to me, well, just go talk to Dick. And I said, oh, he won't listen to me. I need to just accept him as he is, with a growl. She said, well, that's silly. But I never went and talked with him. I just bypassed that difficulty by gosh-showing to him every time I saw him. He gosh-showed to me. And so I wasn't able to work with the difficulty. I didn't. I, 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 he might have. If I had just said to him, just been assertive with him, who knows, something might have happened. That might have been bad, but at least I would have tried. At least I wouldn't have hidden behind my persona, my spiritual persona. So I did that. We all do that. It's not something to blame ourselves for. Just something to notice. Just something to notice. Also, masking fear. Spiritual bypassing, masking fear. So how many times did I say to myself over the years when I was just annoyed about something or something wasn't going well, Tim is just an illusion. Tim's just an illusion. Well, of course, Tim's just an illusion, but what isn't an illusion? And since everything is illusion, everything is real too. So that kind of spiritual bypassing masked my fear. So we can notice that, can't we? We can notice that. The fourth one is enmeshment, which is a Western psychological term, enmeshment. So my friend Sheridan from years ago, she had never really developed good boundaries in her family with her parents or with her brother or anyone. So when her brother was having all kinds of problems, Sheridan was having all kinds of problems. When her brother couldn't sleep well at night, Sheridan couldn't sleep well at night. These boundaries were so enmeshed that Sheridan couldn't have a self separate from her brother, which she had kind of gotten from her family. So this enmeshment, a lot of us experience, and we think, we just sort of accept it and think we're being bodhisattvas but we're not being bodhisattvas by staying awake in the middle of the night worrying about our loved one. If we're staying awake in the middle of the night, that's not bad. It's just that we're not bodhisattvas. We're enmeshed, right? We're enmeshed. And the opposite of enmeshment, again, in Western thought, is disengagement. So I was enmeshed because my dad wanted me to be a certain way, and I couldn't be that way. I didn't think. I got confused. I wanted to be my own self. So what did I do? I moved from Palo Alto, California to northern Minnesota. That is crazy. Because I was enmeshed, I had to get away physically, psychologically, and spiritually. And so I disengaged. Disengagement, though, is the mirror image of enmeshment. Buddhist way is engagement, the middle way. So then I worked for years as part of my practice on coming back to the middle, engaging. So the boundaries are there, but the sense of camaraderie is there, too. And we're not caught by the other person's expectations of us and feelings about us. So that's it. That's our lifetime practice. But spiritual bypassing, we think, whew, I'll just ignore this enmeshment or this disengagement instead of just coming back to it and trying to be engaged with it. But sometimes we have to disengage. Sometimes the enmeshment is too strong. I had to come to northern Minnesota. That's okay. I mean, I could have gone to Alaska or New York. I don't know why I chose northern Minnesota. The mystical version of it is that Katagiri was coming here and I didn't know. That's the mystical version. That's the version I like. Because then my old teacher showed up here and I said to Linda, oh, look at this. And she said, oh, no. So the fifth thing that we do, and you may or may not be lucky enough to do this, you have an enlightenment experience. And then you're more enlightened than everybody else around you. And you get some spiritual arrogance going. Woof! Woof, I got it. I'm sorry that you're in pain. You just said, hang out with me a little more. or whatever. So those are examples of spiritual bypassing, and that's how some ways in which we can think about it. It's important to pay attention to it because any time we try to jump over our difficulty into spirituality, we're usually bypassing it.
So,
opportunity, difficulty is opportunity, is facing, entering, and working through pain. Facing, entering, and working through pain. Checking in, not checking out. Not checking in. The subtle difference between checking in and not checking out. It's big. It's important, but it's subtle. It's subtle. So, I gave a talk a few weeks ago, and I talked about Buddha's statement that the Dharma is good in the middle. Good in the beginning, good in the middle, good in the end. Well, that's wonderful. That's the absolute truth. Everything is what it is. And because it is, it's good. Regardless of what happens. Because the miracle is that there is life. And life is coursing through us, the whole universe. That's good in the beginning, good in the middle, good in the end. That's the absolute truth. But the relative truth and the absolute truth are one in Zen, right? One. The relative truth may be that I'm still feeling grief for my cat that died 2 years ago. I'm still grieving. We actually had to give our cat away, and I'm still grieving. That's the relative truth. 2 years later, I'm grieving about a stupid cat. Oh, he's not stupid. Don't say that. I miss him. That's the relative truth. I miss him. He didn't behave, so he got kicked out. He didn't know. We got a homeless little kitten. Be careful of getting a homeless kitten. It's like adopting a child. If you're going to adopt a child who's been homeless, be careful. Know what you're getting into. Make a commitment and try to stay with it. We stayed with it as long as we could. Anyway, enough on that. We do our best. We do our best. So, if we do this practice of staying with our difficulty, we're going to fail sometimes and we're going to feel ashamed. And the relative truth is, I feel ashamed. Gee. And that's good in the beginning, good in the middle, good in the end, because it's the absolute truth. It's just what is. Just what is. Sometimes everything isn't okay. And that's okay. That's okay. Before we can heal, we need to be honest. We need to be vulnerable. And if we do that, it leads to deeper spirituality. We don't spiritually bypass so much. We just don't. We're more alive with whatever is. And last time I said that the most important component of treating difficulty as opportunity is persistence. A diamond is a piece of coal that has thrived under stress. We do our best, we fall flat on our face, we do our best, we fall flat on our face, we do our best, we fall flat on our face. Maybe we really don't quite do our best, but we fell flat on our face anyway. Pain and humiliation. But if I stay wide open, without any hint of judgment or criticism, as I said last time, that scoops out a place in my heart where love naturally can rest. That scoops out a place in your heart where love naturally rests. It naturally rests there. The more we open up to and embrace our failures, along with other wounds, the more we can rest in that space where everything is good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end. Right in the middle of our inadequacy, our pain, our heartbreak, right in the middle of that. So even if we fail, in Zen, failing is fine, and never succeeding at something is fine. So even if we do our best and keep falling and keep failing and keep feeling and keep getting up and keep getting up and keep getting up, we can succeed spiritually. Because, as I said last time, if we do this sincerely, our empathy increases, our humility increases, and we become more resilient. Out of the pain and humiliation, there's a wellspring of compassion and love that comes up. And humility, we need to surrender the notion that we deserve something better. Sorry, you don't deserve anything better. You just deserve to be. You have this wonderful life that's been given to you, and you deserve nothing better than just this. But you deserve this. Wow, this is what you deserve. You're pretty lucky you've got this. You have this. It has you. And this isn't fake humility. Fake humility is spiritual bypassing or passive-aggressive behavior. As what I used to do with my wife. We had to have 10 years of counseling to get through this gosh-showing. It didn't take a whole 10 years. It only took 9.5. And an increase in resilience. We become more resilient. So success, if it isn't accompanied by failure, hardens us. If it's accompanied by failure, it softens us. It opens up our hearts so that we can feel still inside, still, not fake, right here, alive. So I'm giving a shorter talk today because I want to talk with you guys about the five hints that I'm giving to see view and practice with difficulty and failure as opportunity. So those hints are on your program. I'll talk a little bit about them. I talked about them last time. Two or three people came up to me afterwards and said, oh, they'd like to have discussion about them. So if the two or three of you are here today, maybe you'll take the lead. And if you aren't here, or if you don't want to take the lead, fine. But first I'll talk about them, okay? Instead of spiritual bypassing, hint one, engage persistently and wholeheartedly in each activity you deeply care about. In each activity, engage wholeheartedly and persistently in each activity you deeply care about. So, when I was a kid, and actually a young adult, I loved to shoot baskets and play basketball. We had a rim in my driveway, you know, a backboard and a rim that my dad put up. And I played every day. But I was small. So it was wonderful playing by myself, but what about when the neighbor kids my age came to play with me? I couldn't get the basket in. They blocked it every time. Well, that was difficulty, right? That was difficult. But I love playing basketball, and I actually love playing with my friends. So I worked on my hook shot, and I'm left-handed. So those of you who know basketball, I developed a left-handed hook shot that could go over all of my friends except my really tall friend. I had a friend who was 6'4", 13 years old. I didn't want him to play with us. So I developed this left-handed hook, which just was wonderful. I still usually lost the games, but I did it. And then they caught on to that. And then they said, this shrimp, he has a left-handed hook. You guard that. So then I started working on my right-handed hook. I couldn't write with my right hand, and I can barely write with my left hand. And that's another story. But I practice every day. I practice my right-handed hook. So then I learned I had a right-handed and a left-handed hook. And except for that 6'4" guy, I could score 2 points in every game. Now they may get 18, but I got two. We generally would pay to 21. They'd get two, or maybe I'd get four or six. So I loved it. I did it. It was great. No regrets. It was cool. Well, that's the first hint. The second hint is become intimate with each emotion without repressing or indulging. When we have strong negative emotions that repeat, they usually come from wounds in our childhood or adolescence. So you're not. You can spiritually bypass those, but that's not so healthy, you guys. They come from deep wounds inside you. Deep wounds that are calling for your love and your attention. They're calling for it. So as much as possible, become intimate with each emotion without repressing it or indulging it. Hint three, replace I am a failure with I haven't succeeded at this. That's all. Replace I am a failure with I haven't succeeded at this. You're not tainted in your essence. You're not tainted. You just didn't succeed at this, whatever it was. Both fear and failure are impermanent. They're impermanent. So as moment you think you're tainted, you're ascribing permanence to something that's not permanent. It's open. It's changing. It's moving. So it's a risk when we pursue opportunities in the middle of difficulty. It's a risk. It's hard. But it's our practice. And we do that instead of fighting, fleeing, or freezing. Anytime we do that, that's wonderful. And sometimes we need to fight, flight, or freeze. That's okay. Don't measure it. You know, we're all fallible. All fallible. The fourth hint. Notice each should or shouldn't. Notice each time you say should or shouldn't to yourself. Notice it. And discard those that inhibit your authenticity. You can get a sense as what is just your internal tyrant, which is an internalization of some authority figure from your past, and what is really something that authentically you want to do and you want to manifest. So as much as possible, if I'm angry at my sister for something she did 10 years ago, and I'm still carrying around that anger. I talk to her on the phone every month, but I never mention that. Right? I never mention that. Well, and then I start judging myself, saying I shouldn't be doing this. But there it is. The anger is still there after 10 years. So, can I be with that? Can I just notice that the should that says I shouldn't do that, and how it comes from my own father, and how I've internalized that? Can I do that? And not be caught by it, and just come back to working with the fact that it's a little bit hard for me to talk to my sister about this sensitive issue, and how am I going to do that, and when's the right time? I'm not going to force myself to do it. I'm just going to find the time to talk with her, or create the right environment, and then take a risk. And the fifth hint. Disempower anguish or failure through appropriate sharing instead of hiding. Again, we tend to hide when we're doing spiritual stuff. We tend to hide inside and we don't know. Of course, we tend to hide when we're not doing spiritual stuff too. But I think, again, in spiritual stuff more because we're trying to manifest some deep stillness and sense of compassion and interdependence, we hide then from our more gross, afflictive emotions. And we don't want people to see them. We don't want to see them ourselves. So we're trying to disempower our anguish or failure through appropriate sharing instead of hiding. Instead of just hiding within this little shell of risk aversiveness and fear. That's how we disempower our warts, by acknowledging to ourselves and to others what's going on. There's an very interesting and wonderful phenomenon that's happened in our culture in the last 25 years, and that is the openness about depression in particular, but also bipolar, depression and bipolar. 25 years ago, nobody had depression or bipolar in this Sangha because nobody would admit it. you wouldn't admit it. You didn't want to do that. You wanted to, you know, it was a stain on your psyche to admit it. And little by little, year by year, more and more people are telling me they're depressed. And usually it takes 4 or 6 one-to-ones, or even 15 or 20. But some people are telling me in the very beginning, the first one, that never used to happen because they were with a guiding teacher. You know, the guy on the high seat. So this is wonderful. This is an unburdening that really helps us. That really helps us as human beings. We carry around, so many of us, a secret shame. A secret shame. Maybe not depression, some kind of secret shame. But if we can just see it, be with it, acknowledge it, and share with it with someone we trust, we disempower it. It comes back, but we disempower it. We're no longer ashamed about being ashamed. That's just what it is. Just what it is. Part of life. Part of life. So these 5 hints are to help you, to help me, cross the threshold of painful emotion again and again and again. Again and again and again. So that we can turn this little piece of coal into a diamond. Of course, in Mahayana Buddhism, it already is a diamond, it just doesn't know it. But since this little coal doesn't know it's a piece of diamond, it has to undergo, has to just be with what it is, under stress, not always under stress. You shouldn't artificially create stress. You know, I give a talk like this, and then people go around saying, "Oh, yes, difficulty. I have plenty of difficulty. I'm going to sit all sashin. I'll have more difficulty." No, no. This is your life. This is not. You don't need anything extra. Just be with your life, okay? So coal into diamonds. Coal into diamonds. So the diamond is a big deal in Buddhism. Why is it a big deal? Why do we have the Diamond Sutra? What is the Diamond Sutra about? It's the diamond is very sharp. It cuts away all of this spiritual bypassing thinking that we do. It cuts it away. All of this worries and concerns and upsetness and trying to be better or worse or worrying about the impression we're making or feeling inadequate and going over and over. All this stuff, it cuts away. It cuts away. And what happens when the Diamond Sutra cuts this away, or the diamond, the Vajra diamond in the Tibetan Buddhism, but also in Mahayana? That's the sword, the diamond sword, which can cut everything away. What happens? Translucence. The diamond is translucent, transparent, luminous, enlightened. Right? Our natural state. Our natural state. So, through this practice, we can cut through. And when we do, we discover and manifest this jewel mirror inside, right here. Right in the middle of all these difficulties. Right here. And then we see that on the outside, there's the same luminosity, the same luminosity. So Dogen says, the world and the 10 directions, there are 10 directions in Buddhist cosmology, is one bright pearl, which he gets from the Chinese teachers of the Tang Dynasty. One bright pearl. Everything is one bright pearl. The bright pearl here is a bright pearl of all of life. And it's things just as they are. The relative world. Not just the so-called absolute world. It doesn't know the difference. It just glows. Just shines. So when I talk about this, I talk about the piece of sand in the oyster. You want to bypass a piece of sand in your oyster. I know you want to bypass it. I want to bypass mine too. I don't even want to go down to the beach anymore because I'm going to get more sand in my oyster. Right? But there's your opportunity, that piece of sand in your oyster. There's the opportunity to be with it with a wholehearted openness. And that's where you grow your pearl. And of course, your pearl that you grow is already here. It's just a metaphor. It's already here. So, that's what I want to say. And now I would like to do what a couple people wanted to do last time, which is discuss any of these five hints that you'd like to discuss. And I will read them. But you also have them in your program there. Hint one, engage persistently and wholeheartedly in each activity you deeply care about. Hint two, become intimate with each negative emotion without repressing or indulging. Hint three, replace I am a failure with I have not succeeded at this. Hint four, notice each should or shouldn't, discarding those that inhibit authenticity. Hint five, disempower hidden failure or anguish through appropriate sharing. So we can talk about any of these you'd like to talk about, and you can share what you've learned or ask me a question or talk about how you're dealing with one or more of them or disagree with them. That's fine. Disagree with them. And I'll be Nagarjuna. Yes?
I wonder if you could say something about fear of failure. Because it seems almost like it comes before this stuff.
Fear of failure. Well, fear of failure is natural. It's part of the human condition. So if you don't have fear of failure, you're repressing or you're suppressing or you're really using chemicals. Really big time. Never not using it, right? So it's natural. It's part of life, fear of failure. So we know that. I have fear that I'm going to fail. I have fear this morning. How am I going to get up on this thing? You know, I have numbness in my toes due to my advanced age or something, which I'm getting acupuncture for. And so my balance is a little. How am I going to get up here? So fear of failure. Natural. Natural. And what do we want to do when we have fear of failure? We want to fight it. God, why do they make this thing so high? That is ridiculous. That, me fighting it, even though I authorized it and knew how it was going to be. That's my fighting. I don't know if Dale's here today. Dale, why did you make this so high? That's fighting. Or then, I'm not going in there with that. I have numbness in my toes. Ted, please remove this. I'm an old guy with numbness in my toes, and you authorized this. Remove it. That's fleeing. I want to change the situation or flee. I would like maybe to flee from giving the talk at all, because you'll see how clumsy I am when I get up. But since I can't, and then, or I freeze. I come in, I'm just kind of rigid. I look at this thing as if it was a dinosaur. I sort of struggle with it, and I don't relax during the whole talk, right? So we do that. We fight, we flee, or we freeze. But none of those really are treating difficulty as opportunity. So rather than beating ourselves up, there's the opportunity. Here's the opportunity. Yeah.
I kind of have a question about the same one, actually. Like, kind of more on what you just said. Is saying I'm a failure, or replacing I'm a failure with I have not succeeded at this, is that, like, different than just kind of, like, ignoring failure and just, like, kind of, like, moving on or whatever?
I think ignoring failure is not very healthy. But also, going on and on about your failure is not very healthy either. So here I failed. I fell down on this, and now I'm gonna try to do it. But to say that I'm a failure, you are not a failure at anything. You did. Maybe I failed. I failed like 250 times in doing that hook shot. But so I'm a failure at basketball? No. I wanted to do that in my heart. I was going to I was going to do that. I didn't know if I'd ever... No, but I'm not a failure. I'm not a failure at basketball just because I'm 5'6 and everybody blocks my shots all the time. Although I'm probably only 5'4 now because I'm an old guy, you know. I don't want to get my height measured anymore. Right?
Since you're not going to do it, I'm going to take this discussion about failure and turn it into an opportunity to shamelessly plug your upcoming book.
Oh, okay.
In which there's an entire chapter that's entitled "When Failure Is Just an Experience."
Oh, that's good. You see, hear that? She's got a chapter in my book called "When Failure Is Just an Experiment."
Experience.
An experience. Oh, an experience.
These are the conversations we're supposed to have in
private. Okay. Thank you. Yeah, Raymond.
So, on the same theme, would perfectionism kind of be the flip side of that?
Perfectionism is a little dangerous, and more of us, some of us are more perfectionists than others. Then we just have to notice that our perfectionism makes us freeze or flee or fight, and just say, "Oh, this is one of my warts that I'm a perfectionist, and I can work with that and learn from that." So. That's all. Aaron.
How is this How is this to be reconciled with
Eric, excuse me. A-R-I-C-K. Right?
I'm not sure whose name it is. How is this to be reconciled with those throughout history who have chosen to be a hermit?
How does this relate to those who've chosen to be a hermit? Choosing to be a hermit is cool. It's cool. If that's deep in your heart, to do a hermit practice, just to live out in nature, that's in your heart. That's deepest in your heart. If you're not running away, if you're wanting to go deep within, and gee, doing 18 days, priests here have to do 18 days of retreats. That's 18 days of hermit. Because we have to do that sometimes, or we'll get carried away by the world. So being a hermit is fine. That's not my path, but that's a wonderful path. But being a hermit, running off to the monastery to avoid dealing with your issues, and thinking that somehow it's going to be more spiritual there, it'll be more spiritual for a couple days till your issues start coming up. Or maybe a couple weeks if you really fake it. I mean, you know. Sure. Carrie, and then Chris.
On that note, being a hermit, or maybe not to that extent being a hermit, but engaging in your spiritual practice to the extent that it would take time away from other responsibilities or duties, right?
Yeah.
Like the mother.
Yeah.
So what are my responsibilities to my two grown sons?
Yeah.
Though they want me to be a certain way and around, or like sitting in my house making food. My passion, brings me joy is to sit here for 18 days.
Yes. It's a dilemma. It's a difficulty. And the middle way is to engage with that. And these are two things I really love, because you really love your sons, and you really love the practice. So, how are you going to juggle? How are you going to be with both those? Yeah, that's a very legitimate difficulty, and you can go into your heart and be with that, and get support from others, and just be with that. So that you can do it, if you care about both in almost equally, then you're wanting to do both. And if the sons are moving on to a little more autonomy, then you're able to do this one more, or less autonomy, and you just sort of have to feel your way along.
Can I say one more thing?
Sure.
About the, you know, the concern that I am a failure. I think about that around
on parenting too, right? That I have not succeeded in this. I can't say that if I, as a parent, have failed my children in the past, you know, because I did the best I could.
Oh, that's right.
But that wasn't what they needed.
That's right. Yeah, you did the best you can. And even when we screw up and we hurt someone, usually if we do the best we can. Now sometimes we don't do the best we can, and that's okay too. It's okay too. That's life. We're all imperfect. But labeling myself as a failure is going to really repress, really limit my ability to just enjoy and appreciate being alive right now. And so if I say that to myself, then I need to notice it and get help reframing it, or use my zazen to reframe it, or something. Thank you, Carrie. And Chris?
Okay, so given a difficult emotion, you sit and be with it and get to know it, I found that, at least in the past, it was useful to me to do one of the immeasurable minds.
Could you speak a little louder? Because you've actually got a big voice.
Okay, I'll try. So, when facing a difficult emotion, and you have the option to sit and be with it or to maybe apply loving kindness or something like that, where do you find the line between, say, loving kindness being a bypass versus a skillful means?
Oh, could you hear what he asked? Some of you could and some of you couldn't. He said, well, if you're experiencing a difficult emotion, when is it okay, when is it appropriate to use loving kindness as your tool in your meditation, and when is using loving kindness a spiritual bypass? Is that what you're saying?
Right.
Well, that's interesting. And of course, I don't have an answer to that. Loving kindness can be really helpful to bring ourselves back, to help us open up and be more with whatever is going on. But we can overdo it, and it can become sort of just something that we automatically do to ignore our deep feelings, our anguish, or our sorrow. So loving kindness is very important to bring ourselves back so that we can reach in and reach out. But if it becomes the one sacred mantra, then usually we're doing spiritual bypassing by not really being in touch with the feelings underneath. So, I don't know, you have to feel your way along. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anybody else? Yeah. Oh, it's a couple people. Ben and then Chris. Okay. Ben.
Can you say something? You talked a little bit ago about having a dream or an aspiration.
Yeah.
Can you say something about the difference between just trying to be with something and stripping away all the shoulds and trying to be authentic versus trying to become, having an aspiration to be more peaceful?
Sure. Well, again, I say both and. The aspiration to live a more peaceful life, that's not spiritual bypassing. That's coming right from your heart, right directly from your heart, that aspiration. And you want to keep that aspiration alive. But sometimes that aspiration will get covered up by your discouragement, your feeling of hopelessness. If you don't acknowledge your feeling of discouragement and hopelessness, it's hard to get that aspiration going again. So you need to acknowledge that you're feeling discouraged, hopeless, and that's the way things are. And be with that, and then the aspiration, you'll be able to do the aspiration, it won't be dry. If the aspiration is just dry, if it has no heart sustenance in it, then you know that you're not, there's something in your heart that you need to pay more attention to. But both and. And the more we see through these layers of junk that cover up our hearts from our spiritual bypassing the other things we do, the more they begin to dissolve, and our aspiration then takes more life on. Larry, Lawrence.
Getting back to failures, I found that I've always learned more from failures than successes. Seems, and I recall when you were David Dillon lines.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, there's no such thing as failure, and that failure is no success at all.
Yes. One of my many favorite Dillon lines. Yeah. There is no success like failure, and failure is no success at all. Which I could give about 32 talks on. Chris.
Yeah, my question is actually on Nagarjuna. However, one thing that some of us might remember from when we were little kids or much younger than we are now, with a to replace I am a failure, that some of us had our first glimpses of Buddhist thinking as children through the character of Yoda. As far as there is no try, there's what we do and there isn't. But with the character of Nagarjuna, because I wasn't part of the middle way class, as those or envied that, he said, if you disagree with this, then I'll be Nagarjuna. Did he have a method like Socrates, where in discussion his goal is to break down the assumptions of the student?
That's right. In some ways, he was very similar to Socrates. Very similar. Nagarjuna is the diamond cutter. He takes what's in the Diamond Sutra and the Heart Sutra, and he logically deconstructs it. In the Diamond Sutra and the Heart Sutra, they don't logically deconstruct all of our thoughts about who we are, but he does it in a logical way. And each of the people who comes to me, he shows the logical fallacy in their belief.
I had professors in college that would say, Socrates wouldn't present, this is what you should know, and this is the truth of the answer to people. He'd just say, let me take apart what you think.
Yeah, so in that way, they're very similar. And, you know, Socrates said the unexamined life is not worth living. Well, Nagarjuna would agree with that, but then he would examine that assumption. If somebody came to him and said the unexamined life was not worth living, he would say, what is this you're examining? Who is examining it? What is being examined? And he would stay with the person until...
Having an existential crisis? Well, I just talked to Dr.
Yeah. Good. Thanks for bringing that up. It's a good point. I don't know Socrates nearly as well as Nagarjuna. Because I was... I'm steeped more in the Eastern than Western, except for psychology. Anybody else? Lawrence.
I think I always loved about Nagarjuna is that he always seemed to not be with anything to hold on to, uncompromising.
So yes, that's right.
He wouldn't have some kind of an idea.
Yes. Yeah. So he's pronouncing it Nagarjuna, and Lawrence is saying, do you want to say it loud?
Yeah. What I've always liked about Nagarjuna from reading years ago was he was so uncompromising. He never left you with any kind of thing to hold on to.
Right. So Nagarjuna is uncompromising. He never leaves you with anything to hold on to. And at the end, Nagarjuna said, and those who believe in emptiness or have any interest in emptiness are the worst off of all. And I'm paraphrasing. There are lots of different ways to paraphrase.
Quote, but so those who hold emptiness as a view are incorrigible.
Okay, here's his. He's doing this literally. So say it loud.
Those who hold emptiness as a view are incorrigible, which is pretty funny because everything else was sort of corrigible. The only ones who wasn't was incorrigible, ones who have it as a view.
And those who hold emptiness as a view are incorrigible. Well, we're all incorrigible. Let's just enjoy it. Let's just be who we are. Okay. I like being incorrigible, don't you? Okay, thank you.